We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Hello, everybody. Welcome, and thank you for joining us for Maximizing Intervention and Minimizing Math Anxiety Strategies for Student Success with Bethany Lockhart Johnson. We're so excited to have all of you here today. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and pass it over to our wonderful speaker today, Bethany.
Hi, thanks, Ryan. I'm really excited to be here with you today. We're talking about intervention. We're talking about math anxiety. We're going to talk a little about math fluency. And all of this is centered around our desire for student success. I saw a couple of folks who said they were students themselves. So maybe you're working with young people, or maybe you yourself are kind of reclaiming math and reimagining what math can look like. So I want to say first, you know, obviously we all have such a wide background in the students we serve. And so there's no one intervention or one strategy that is going to work for all students. But the, you know, I'm glad we're here today, because we're all committed to how do we make our spaces work for our students. So I'm in Southern California. I'm a K-5, primarily K-5 educator. I attended University of San Diego and then UC Irvine for my master's and my multiple subject credential. And I previously taught theater and dance. So I love moving, bringing movement and music and the arts into my classroom spaces. I co-host the Math Teacher Lounge with Dan Meyer. You may know him if you work in upper ed. He's works with Amplify and Desmos and have an amazing curriculum work that he's done. So the framework that I'm bringing to this space today, I believe that all students need and are worthy of multiple rich opportunities to engage in problem solving and sense-making processes. I believe that all students are capable of making sense of a given context, and every student brings a tremendous amount of knowledge and schema to our classroom, to the math classroom. And I truly believe that our students are influenced by our disposition of mathematics and by our classroom environments. So today we're going to talk a little bit about math intervention, again, about what does that have to do with math anxiety? What does it have to do with fluency? And then some next steps. So I want you to imagine if you got to follow a student around in your school or in a school environment for a whole year, what would the story of mathematics look like? You might be able to sit back and think, what was my experience or what was my journey of mathematics my fourth grade year or my third grade year? And I personally definitely have a few years that stick out very vividly. Especially in high school, I definitely navigated intense math anxiety. I did not feel as if it was a space where I was welcome or that I was capable. And I had a teacher who reinforced that. And it wasn't until I was an adult and decided to reclaim mathematics that I ultimately really fell in love with talking about math, thinking about mathematics, and thinking about how do we create math spaces where all of our students feel welcome, where they feel that they can thrive. I'm now a mama of a little three-year-old, and when he is not running and shouting no, I'm trying to infuse our days with math content and with the opportunity to believe that math is everywhere. So that might look like counting flowers on our walk or exploring the number of items we purchase at a grocery store, or counting the trucks that he's playing with, or drawing lines or circles. It can look like all sorts of things. But back to the question. So if you were with a student for a whole year, what would it look like? But it's pretty unrealistic, right? How can we just follow a student for 1 year? But what about for a week? Would we do that? But what about for a class period, just one class period? Could we, with a partner, especially a student who, let's say, is pulled out for intervention, could we take a look at what is the story of that student's math experience just in that class period? So my colleague, Jody Guarino, she is a professor at UCI and works for the Orange County Department of Education, and she decided to do just that. She and another colleague followed two students, and these students were it was a sixth grade classroom. These students were in their core classroom 2 days a week, and the other 3 days they were pulled out to a resource room, and where there were five total students, and the five students had IEPs. So the goal was to just see what was happening. The primary classroom teachers didn't feel like they really knew what was happening. The resource teachers didn't really know what was happening there, but they cared about these students. They were following the IEP goals. And so I want to spend just a couple minutes walking you through a couple snapshots of what they found. And it started out where that you'll see there's two columns. So on one side, there's what's happened. There's the time column. And then there's what's happening in the resource math classroom. Again, that pullout classroom. And what's happening in that general education math classroom. And Dr. Guarino speaks to this work much more eloquently and much more depth than I will do today. So I am not even pretending that I can do justice to the way that they unpacked what they found. But I wanted to start with this because I don't think this is indicative, and Dr. Guarino has said this. She says that when she's talked about this work, often what happens is people are quick to say, oh, well, that's just that resource classroom, or it's just that teacher that didn't have the experience to be able to meet certain criteria for our students with IEPs, or it's just that group of students. And I want to caution us to, as we look through this, it's like, well, let's not make it about this particular class or these particular students. Let's just be curious. So the students in the resource math classroom, they were given a warm-up. And so there was a worksheet. It was a multiplication worksheet. And they were asked to solve this. And they said, you have 10 minutes to solve it. In the general education math classroom, they were talking about, like, let's just talk about rectangles today. And what are words that we use to describe the shape? So words that students shared were the opposite lines were parallel, perimeter, length, width, base, height. So they're talking about it. They're kind of diving into this topic. So at 9:55, students still working on the worksheet in the resource classroom. In the core curriculum classroom, students are broken into groups to collaboratively work in stations where they're going to look at how can shapes be rearranged into rectangles. And they're going to have materials to manipulate and to work together. In the other classroom, as they're talking about this worksheet, they then transition to doing another worksheet, very similar, but this time they got a calculator. And again, in the other side, the teachers are walking around, talking to the different students, engaging with them and trying to find out what conversation is happening as students try to create rectangles with these shapes. So while the core curriculum students are changing stations, the other teacher is saying, you know, we were working in on perimeter. And so again, they're also working on rectangles. And they said, let's talk about perimeter. And the resource that they were using was from Khan Academy, a third grade lesson. And students were given time to write down the example to draw it. And the class continues on, but what I want to highlight, there's two things I want to highlight. One, I want to look at like the discourse and the language of the discipline that's happening in that general education classroom. No matter what your level of understanding about the properties of a rectangle or the way you would find the area or the perimeter, the conversation that's happening is rich with that language of the discipline and with words that are going to be infused in those conversations that you're working with in a group. I also want to note that the work that was happening in the intervention classroom was below grade level. And I think so often when we think about what our students are capable of, it can be easy to say, oh, my student's not ready for that grade level work. But one of the things that we see happening time and time again is that then students are not introduced or permitted to engage in the grade level work in a way that is meaningful and that is accessible. And so I want to think about how could that happen? Had those students with the IEP been in that core classroom, what would they have been experiencing? Would they have been able to contribute in the exact same way as their peers or make sense of the work? I don't know, right? Like, I don't know, and I'm not saying that that's exactly where they should have been. But what I think our students deserve is rich discourse, is grade level appropriate work, and they deserve an opportunity to engage in a work that's meaningful in a space that's safe. And caveat, I'm not saying that resource space wasn't safe. I'm saying that we want our classrooms, whatever our classrooms are, our resource spaces, our primary classrooms, we want them to be safe for our students to take risks and make meaning. So I don't want to miss out on the opportunity to be curious about this and think about what intervention can look like and what it might typically look like. And if you've ever done in this exercise before, you may have gotten similar results. You may have gotten completely different results. But I want to invite you to imagine doing this and to see if it's possible. Could you do this? So how can we learn about the story of math for your students needing support and intervention? And when I talk about intervention, I'm talking about any student who might need sustained support beyond core class instruction. So it could be a student who needs specific accommodations based on an IEP. Some of that support might be pull-out support. Sometimes it's push-in support. Or sometimes these students need support in a small group setting or supplemental instruction that's happening outside of core instruction time. So, you know, when I was doing my research, something I loved was this excerpt from this article by the Cleveland Clinic. And, you know, I've thought about how we solve math problems, and I often like watch my son, you know, figuring out something, tinkering with something, and I'm like trying to watch like what's going on in his brain, right? So they were talking about how to solve a problem, right? And so they're saying for a math problem, like 2 + 2, you're thinking about first that visual processing. So the just seeing the entirety of the math problem and processing that. Short-term memory, holding on to the specifics of the math problem as they're working on it. The language, the part of your brain that's translating the symbols and what that means. And so we know what a plus sign mean or an equal sign or question mark, that these symbols, this language means something to us. Your long-term memory, to remember how do I solve a math problem or how do I access that knowledge if it's something that I'm fluent in. And then understanding of the quantities or amount. Your brain says this 2 represents a quantity. It represents a specific amount. And then like maybe I've seen pictures of this and then I can picture the 2 and the 2 and I can add it together and I can see the 4. There's so much happening, right? And then I'm calculating it and I'm saying 2 + 2 = 4, right? So for some students, at any point, something in that line of steps, right? If for most of us, it might happen in an instant. But for many of us, especially for those of us who need support beyond core curriculum or who experience math anxiety, there's some point in there. It's like a kink in the hose, right? There's some support that something that where we could use additional support. And I do want to take a second to say dyscalculia, is a learning disorder. And so researchers have said, you might've heard of it. And researchers have, sometimes people liken it to dyslexia, but it is, which would be more about language. But with dyscalculia, the idea is, so some people say that there's developmental side of it, where it could be based on a student's, like attributed to external factors, like a student's behavior or attention in the classroom settings. Teacher instruction and preparation level, like whether the student received adequate instruction. But then there's the other side that researchers said, well, there's also dyscalculia where students have a developmental learning disorder that actually limits students' ability
to look at a symbol, let's say the number four, and recognize that symbol. And when they look at that number, it doesn't have the meaning that it might have for a student who does not have a specific learning disorder. And so in some studies, they found that a student was able to look at a collection of dots, and they were able to see that collection of dots and recognize that those four, that was four. They were able to count it and accurately see that quantity. When they actually saw that number, it didn't mean anything, right? So when I talk about intervention, we have this wide range in our classroom. And there, again, there's no one intervention that's going to meet every student's needs. But how can we look at what are the interventions? What is that story of math at our site? And what's being provided for those students who do need that intervention? So when you go look, let's imagine you're going to look at the story of math at your site. So you're wondering, who is this intervention for? What's the setting of it? Where is it happening? What's the duration? Is it like a 10-minute small group pullout? Is it a whole class period? And is the material the student's working at grade level? And then you also want to consider the teacher preparedness. And I don't mean, oh, they're a good teacher, they're not a good teacher. But oftentimes, I do look at what kind of supports are in place for our resource teachers. The teachers who are delivering the instruction have, I know the support providers in my sites have been so rich with tools and eager to like collaborate. But is there time given for that collaboration? Are those resource teachers included in our grade level meetings or in the curriculum, or were we able to meet about the unit ahead of time? So what are those supports in place? So those questions might take a back seat when you actually go in and just get curious about what students are experiencing. But those are some questions that I think about. And I wonder, what could the intervention look like? Could it look like something that involved games, either in person or computer-assisted technology that supported a specific concept? And I especially think about, what can I do today in my classroom? What is a specific accommodation, a routine, or a shift that I can make? And how could those interventions address math anxiety? How could those interventions look at, is that student struggling with math fact fluency? And is that at the foundation or the base of where the gap is in terms of my student being able to access the material or feeling like math is a subject that is for them? So in our research, or you might have tried some of these, you might have tried number choice, deciding to have the same concept, but just the number is different so that students maybe are working with more familiar numbers while the operation themselves might be more complicated. Increasing the use of tool use. If computation is not the focus of the problem, could a calculator be used? Does a student need graph paper or some sort of lined grid paper that can help them to organize their work? And that's just the hurdle that prevented them from being able to follow their own work. Could they use partner work or have extra time in exams? Some of my students have needed quiet space to work, and some have needed more noise, right? We were playing classical music in the background. Could you solve a problem as a whole class? Or could you show a student work sample and the student's solving is centered? Or could you have, let's say you have a mock sample, maybe it's from another class, or maybe it's one that you made up, where you want to look through the process and let's figure out what this student was thinking and how they solved it. How can stepping back from the work, you're not changing the grade level of the work. You're not altering, like you're not taking away that discourse in the language of the discipline, but you're making shifts or routines that aren't going to cost you anything money-wise, but could be small shifts that could make a difference for your students. Now, obviously, teachers, we are not going to dive into all these things at once, right? We know our students. We might try something and then we might say, okay, that's not working or that is working. And what I have found is in the hustle and bustle, sometimes it can be really easy to forget the power of formative assessment. And so as you're diving into a particular intervention, making sure that you pause and you take a moment to say, what is working about this or what isn't working about this? It could be a small tweak or it could be something that was more, that maybe just that intervention wasn't the right choice. So I want to talk about math anxiety, and math anxiety could fill up the whole hour. I could fill up 5 hours. And again, I feel a personal connection to it, but I want to talk about it a little bit today because I think sometimes we forget how much math anxiety, whether our own or whether our students, can be the source of that disconnect from mathematics or that student's blocking that student from accessing the material. So Common Core says, I'm in California, so we use Common Core state standards, but I feel like we can all agree that students who are successful in math, they see it as sense, as like sensible, like they can make sense of it. It's useful. It's something that they feel that they are capable of. They believe in diligence and one's own efficacy. They know, hey, yeah, I am capable of solving this, even if it's a hard problem. Those are things that are going to lead to their success in mathematics and in all their subjects, frankly. And math anxiety can be a big block to that ideal. It's often defined as a feeling of tension, apprehension, fear. And those things, when you walk into a classroom and you're feeling fear, can interfere with your math performance. I mentioned I'm a co-host on the podcast Math Teacher Lounge, and we had on a guest, Dr. Heidi Sabnani, and she said that in her research that teachers with math anxiety, so oftentimes as a teacher, we're given choices. We're said, how do you want to, you have these are your choices for professional development. Sometimes it's picked for us, but sometimes we have a choice. And let's say we go to a conference. When we're given the choice, if teachers have math anxiety, they're often avoiding that math-related content. And they're seeking out opportunities that, while it may enrich them as a teacher, it's not building that content knowledge in mathematics. They taught less math over the course of the year. Now, teachers aren't, the teachers she studied weren't skipping math entirely. But what happens is those instructional minutes get eaten up, right? So I talked to a teacher who, when she was choosing to like read the daily bulletin, or when there was an assembly and they had to see what time slot she was available, she realized that every single time it was during the math block, or her math block was after lunch. And so it was really easy for those instructional minutes to creep. Now, 3, 4, 5 minutes, maybe that doesn't take away from the overall lesson goals you're able to achieve in that day. But your overall course of the year, that's going to be a huge chunk of those minutes for that subject. And so the teachers weren't doing that maliciously. They weren't doing that to harm their students, but a lot of times it was subconscious. Teachers also relied on rote teaching or methods that were ineffective, but maybe they were familiar. Or like dividing fractions. I know I flip it, I go across, I multiply. Great, look, let me teach you this little rhyme that's actually not going to get to the understanding of it. It's not actually going to be effective when you need to use this and apply it, but it's kind of going to get us through. And I'm not, if you've done that, in no way am I saying you're, again, doing that to harm students, but it's like, sometimes that's what we know how to do. That's what we know how to do. And you're like, I know they'll get the answer that way. So if we do this, they'll get the answer. So she looked at, well, what's going to lessen that anxiety? And in her study, when teachers had an opportunity to validate their math anxiety and their math story and have actually a moment to envision what their math classroom culture could look and feel like in opposition to what it was, those teachers participated in a teaching and learning cycle where they were able to sit together and unpack units together. And they were able to plan and work through the units ahead of teaching, which is such a luxury and a gift. And it had to be done very intentionally because we're pulled in so many directions. And the most important part is that there was ample time for teachers to really understand the mathematics and discuss it in ways to teach the material. And that does mean that there had to be a safe space developed where teachers were allowed to ask questions that they might be embarrassed as, well, I should know this. I teach fifth grade. I should know this math that that my students were supposed to learn last year. I should, and you know it, but do you feel comfortable enough with it to step back from the textbook to look at the mathematics, to feel that joy of hearing a student explain their thinking and kind of have that unknown during a share out of, I'm not sure, like, I'm going to venture away, let this conversation happen, and let's talk about these different ways to solve the problem, even if you don't know how the student is going to solve it. It's that like freedom of, I may not know how this student solved it, but I'm not letting my anxiety dictate that I have to follow this letter by letter. Hopefully that makes sense. I'll talk a little bit more about that. And the other thing they did, they worked with a coach and they got to observe their coach teaching math. And I love watching other teachers teach. And it's so powerful to be able to see a teacher and see their strategies and then debrief about it. So you're able to talk with a coach and see how their coach like used positive and affirming messages in their classroom, working with their students. Students work at navigating math anxiety. Themes that I hear, they often recount a specific moment of math trauma. Math is seen as something they just have to get through. Some of the students I talked to said they were told not to use their fingers or not to use tools, or they were embarrassed. A third grader I talked to, they were embarrassed to use tools because that's what you only use that if you didn't know how to solve the problems. After the class, they had no memory of the lesson or strategies taught in the class. And they remember teachers who privileged certain students or students who had the ability to solve a problem quickly. And if we take a second and we think about that math anxiety that the teachers are feeling or that the students are feeling or that you yourself might have felt, I feel like that's in direct contrast to how we want our spaces to feel, how we want our students to feel in the classroom, how we ourselves want to feel. And I truly believe that your classroom can be an environment where students feel safe taking risks as they share their sense-making. This photo is of a little girl who all year had been during share out, she didn't want to share. And on this particular day, I had asked her if she would share out, and the routine in our class after we had solved problems and I'd be walking around talking with students, I would ask a couple students, would you feel comfortable sharing? And I'd take a quick, if they said yes, I'd take a picture of their work and project it. And they got a chance to go up and talk about their work. And this moment, every time I look at this picture, it makes me feel so proud. This is a kindergarten classroom. Was so proud of her because she said, this is how it worked. This is how it made sense to me. And she said she had to draw the chairs and she drew the people. And when I was walking around, I had asked her, well, who has chairs and who doesn't? That's when she had drawn those circles. And it was her, she got to own it, that her thinking was centered in that moment. So I want us to think about a space where students solve problems in ways that make sense to them. When they're doing classroom routines that help broaden what doing math looks and feels like. This is math? And where tool use is a part of the sense-making process and it's celebrated. So when we create a classroom where students' thinking is centered and where students feel safe to take risks, it enhances all students' self-concept, not just those students who need intervention. There's a book that called Sitting Pretty. The author is Rebecca Taussig. And I loved something that she said in it. She uses a wheelchair. And she says that when they put curb cuts in, it was amazing because then she was able to navigate her neighborhood so much easier. But then it also makes it easier for that parent or caregiver who is pushing a child in a stroller and traversing on their walk, or the person wheeling their laundry back from the laundromat, or the child who's riding their bicycle. It helps all of us. And it may have been put in so that somebody with a wheelchair could access it. It may have been, this intervention may be put in place for a student who needs the most help, or what you think they need the most help, but that tool use, for example, can help all students. And students might not access it, but knowing that they can and feeling safe to, that can be really, truly powerful. And when I say self-concept in this context is talking about self-efficacy, your competence beliefs, your what you feel that you are capable of doing. So when researchers assessed mass self-concept, and I have a list of resources at the end if you want to refer to any of these articles, they were assessing things like, how good did the students think they were at math? How did they expect that they would do in the future? How good did they think that they would be at learning something new in math? And unsurprisingly, they learned that when students had a lower level of math self-concept, they had higher levels of anxiety. And the reciprocal, when they had higher levels of math anxiety, they had lower levels of self-concept. So I challenge you that these charts, I think about the work that these teachers did to cut out these circles, to cut out the cones, to make those little roads. But I've talked to students for whom this was a source of anxiety. That student who needed that intervention, that student who only had the one ice cream scoop or the two ice cream scoops, I cannot imagine a teacher who would ever be sitting there cutting this out. Ooh, I need more blue paper. Let me go back to the resource room and get more blue paper because I got to have this, you know, cutting them out, measuring them, make sure they're right size, would want to harm their students. But how are these practices that we believe are in good faith or we believe are going to encourage or excite our students actually causing harm? So I want to talk about a couple of resources that I found that were helpful when thinking about navigating math anxiety. We talked to authors Sarah Strong and Gigi Butterfield in our episode, season 4, episode 4 of Math Teacher Lounge, and they wrote a book called Dear Math, where students wrote letters to math at the beginning of the year. And she talked about all the amazing way that as teachers they use, Gigi was a student in her class, but Sarah used those letters to help inform her instruction throughout the year. And something really powerful when we talk about enhancing self-concept. So she invited her upper grade students to go and support a younger student who was currently in the grade where they experienced their first memory of math anxiety. So let's say, and she taught high school or teaches high school. So let's say a student was in 11th grade and said, oh, when I was in fourth grade, you know, this happened and I didn't know this. And, you know, and they could, that memory, it was visceral. And so her upper grade students reported that when they went into that class, they were able to see that evidence of growth as they worked with these younger students, because all of a sudden these assignments, that material, they could navigate it with greater ease. They may have to refresh their memory on some of the concepts, but they could navigate it. And they felt that power of like, oh, wait, I have learned, I have grown, which sometimes as a student, as a person, can be hard to put your finger on. So how can we make space for our students' math story? An article suggests that whether you write Dear Math letters, you could do a math survey asking students, how do they feel about math compared to other students in the class? Do you think your parents or caregivers like or dislike math? Because they know what you think about math. Sharing what their best or worst math experience was. And I love this one. If I could change one thing about my math classroom, what would it be? So I also want to think about, so how do we use that information as we strive to get to know our students better to help inform the space that we're creating for all students? And I want to talk about how some routines can help shift our classroom culture towards that student-centered thinking and towards more access for all students. Kristen Gray, former director of K-5 Curriculum and Professional Learning, created this amazing resource with her team, I Am Talking Math. This is an example where, again, we're thinking about how can I bring in that discourse, that language, those moments for all of my students. She's putting up this picture of these oranges. And your students are, this is math class, this is math. And then they give examples of what are some questions you could ask if grade K, 1, 2, that are grade level appropriate. Showing a picture of the skateboarder. What questions do you have about the picture? I used to take pictures of things like on my walk, or I took a video of a squirrel trying to like jump over to the next tree, brought it in, just showed it and asked them, what do you notice? What do you wonder? Routines like which one doesn't belong? amazing website, wodb.ca, that has I believe it's K-8. But these amazing art, you can make your own. You don't have to though. They have it for different grade levels. So example, the leaf, any grade level. That middle one was one we did with my kindergarten class. And the idea behind this routine is that you are building students' power to notice, to wonder, and to explain their reasoning. And so the other idea is that there's no right answer. We could come up with a reason why any of these don't belong. An activity like counting collections, amazing resource, Choral Counting and Counting Collections book. A lot of times folks think of counting collections just as something for early educators, but in your upper grades, students can be counting packs of cards. They can be counting groups of objects. They can be counting objects that are much higher quantities or packaged in configurations of 12 or 8, and they can work in teams, and every student can have access at some level to some collection, and you can vary the types of collections that your students are working with. And really, they get creative with how they are making sense of it. And on that last picture, that student was, on this picture, the student was sharing how he solved a problem using these bears. But I would do the same type of share out for counting collections, going around and taking a picture of their collection after they've counted it, and with their permission, projecting it and sharing, would you share how you counted your collection? So that's how those strategies are coming out, because those strategies are from the students. I'm not telling them to group them into tens. I'm not telling them they have to line them up a certain way. They're making sense. Now, this child here, is this child going to fit all those Legos on that paper? They went around and traced each Lego. Is that the most efficient way? No, but he's making sense of it in his own way. And that is okay. It's part of the journey and it's part of the process. Activities where you just post a picture. What do you notice? What do you wonder? Annie Fetter, amazing mathematician, put these questions out. And this can be for any grade level, talking about weight, talking about volume, talking about size, configuration. My kindergartners, when I showed them this picture, said, why are they doing yoga? So you never know what your students are going to notice. Another routine, what is the same, what is different? And this can be for any grade level. So on the left, they may notice that the elephant, elephants are heavy, because they know, elephants are heavier than feathers. But in my classroom, a student said, well, actually the feather's bigger. And students were like, no, an elephant's way bigger. But they were talking about the photo. So we had a really interesting conversation. And at one point, the student went and got a ruler. It was like, no, look, it's bigger because it's this high. I loved it. It was amazing moments. And there's an amazing website, same different images.wordpress.com. And Brian Bouchard, I love what he says here. Same or different is a routine that helps students begin to identify evidence as they notice different attributes that result in similarities and differences. In a way, it's helping children learn how to see and how to share what they see, you know. And I love this, that you're taking these things that can be much more advanced concepts, but the joy is that every student can have access at some level. This is an example of mathematical residue. We did a routine initially when I asked about, tell me about 10. You know, they were like, oh, that's Mackenzie's number, because she's number 10 in the line. But then when we did 14 later in the year, they came up with a lot more abstract, and they started making connections between how they solved and got to 14. And with both of these, I left them up and left post-its. So some students need more time to process. So I would find students who later, you know, give them time, like, hey, by the way, don't forget, you know, that poster's over there. If you come up with another one, add it. And like that little reminder or that nudge, students would go back up and add more. So one thing I really want to emphasize is tool use. Again, it hurt my heart to hear the student who said she wanted to use the tools, but she didn't go get them because she felt like she was going to be made fun of, right? So I want to encourage you to think about, what does tool use look like in your classroom? And are we telling them that tools are going to help them make sense? Are we saying you have to use this tool? Or are we letting them pick the tool that's going to make most sense to them? And are the tools in your classroom easily accessible? A very well-meaning teacher had his tools beautifully organized. I mean, beautifully, but they were like under a thing, behind a cubby. So to get them, it was not something that was intuitive or something that was easy to access, but they were beautifully organized. And do you celebrate when students use tools? Is it just a normal part of your, like, of course we use tools because mathematicians use tools. In my kindergarten classroom, we would keep adding to this list of what a tool can be. A tool can be a pencil, a tool can be a clipboard. And we keep adding to it all year long. And so I'd say, well, what tool do you think you could use? And sometimes they'd say, I could use the watercolor paint as a tool. I think they just wanted to paint. But I loved that they were accessing the tool chart. So what can I say? I also want to honor that teachers, the most frequent thing I hear is, but what if the students make a mess? They'll probably make a mess. What if they play with the tools? They might initially play with the tools. And what if they get dependent on tools to solve problems? They won't. But if they did, mathematicians use tools all the time. And how can you create a culture where we clean it up together? Or this is how, you know, doing a tool talk before the students use it. What do you notice about this? Letting them feel it, letting them stack the Unifix cubes, letting them manipulate them and see. And then how do we take care of them? How could we use them to solve this problem? Setting up those expectations and realizing that it's a learning process for all of us. But celebrating that tool use is an important part of the sense making. And then a couple other strategies I want to make sure I flag. Researchers found that even students just putting their thoughts into paper before an exam, writing about it as openly as possible, about their thoughts and feelings regarding the exam they were about to take, made a difference in lowering math anxiety. And that's something we could all do. Spend 3 minutes writing about your feelings about this exam. Students don't have anxiety, maybe they'll take that time to doodle. But students who do, it could be an opportunity where that becomes a routine. And that is alleviating some of that anxiety. Dr. Gerardo Ramirez also gave a wonderful idea, repeating tests and assignments to allow students a chance for evidence of growth. Just like those students who did the Dear Math letter, who went back and saw how much they'd grown since that moment of math anxiety, repeating a test, you're not going to repeat every test, maybe doing that twice a year, three times a year, or an assignment a couple times, and allowing students to see their growth. What is the test for otherwise? And again, choosing tasks that allow for multiple points of entry. What am I getting from this worksheet where the apple is telling me my goal is to move fast? What am I getting from that versus something that has more open-ended options? So a quick task I'll point out as an example, or I'll quickly point out this task as an example. Again, Dr. Garino, when she was in my class, when we developed this problem, we used it for 5 and then for 10. She has rabbits, and sometimes the rabbits are in the hutch that's in her backyard, and sometimes they're not. So what are all the ways that we could find these rabbits? And I loved this because this was an example that every single student had access. The student on the left who took the image that I gave them to work with and said, oh, you could use this if you want, was a tool that was available to them, had moved the little dots around and ultimately drew 10 bunnies. But they were able to access the problem and share their thinking. 5 are in the hutch and 5 are out. The other student, for them, yeah, they still drew bunnies, but they also did an equation. They also used a number bond. I mean, but both of those are valid. Both of those are ways that I want to celebrate their students' thinking. And both of these students got a chance to share and center their thinking. So that problem got a lot more out of that problem than like a worksheet where I just said, what are all the ways you can make 10? Or choosing a task from my curriculum, saying, okay, this says this girl has 9 pennies. She can't find any more. So now how many does she have? And they want you to use this number path and a number bond and then write the equation. Okay, that could be very accessible for some. But for those it's not, what can you take that and just make a small tweak? Our classroom elephant was Bip. Bip says 9 + 0 = 0. Is he correct? And so I got some elaborate responses drawn out and all these things. And I also had some students who I just had a conversation with. And those students may not have been able to represent it on paper. But those students were able to share their thinking and were part of that activity and part of that experience. So again, this is coming from a place that all of our students are capable of making sense of a given context. And they all are worthy of multiple rich opportunities to engage in problem solving and sense making. We talk a lot more about math anxiety in season 5 of Math Teacher Lounge. running out of time, but we'll briefly want to talk about math fact fluency. And I want to flag that I know that there are some questions coming in, and I will do my best to leave a little time at the end. Any questions that I don't get to hear, I will answer on Twitter, on X. I'm at LockhartEDU, and I'll be happy to respond there and continue the conversation. Students who are fluent solve problems accurately, flexibly, they utilize appropriate strategy, and they solve them efficiently. And I want to just briefly touch on fluency, because when we think about math anxiety, or we think about interventions or students who need more access to support for mathematics, we want those math facts to just be there, to be there and not taking up that working memory. So researchers found that when you are spending all of your cognitive load, your cognitive energy, trying to figure out 7 times 6, you're not then able to focus, you know, if you're counting, if you're skip counting, if you're drawing, you're using all of your energy on that. Well, when it comes to doing the rest of the problem or using that information to figure out the rest of the problem, your stores are drained. You don't have that same level of working memory. So fluency, that's one reason that fluency can be a very, very powerful way that students can have access to the material. And it's also a way that can be a barrier for students to have access. So my students in kindergarten may be using their fingers, and fingers are powerful tools. But in my friend's third grade class, if he's still using his fingers to solve an addition problem or a subtraction problem, well, fingers are still tools. I don't want my students to ever feel shame for using these tools that you have right here. But I don't want him to have to sit there and use that much of his working memory to solve a problem. I want his addition and subtraction facts to be right there so that when we're learning multiplication, that he's got those already. Those are his. So effective fluency practice, amazing researcher, Dr. Val Henry. One of the things I want to focus on is saying that one of the most important things, besides it being strategic, consistent, and focusing on sense making and building that number sense, that when students are learning facts, they're moving from concrete to representational to abstract. And that's building that deep conceptual understanding from concrete to representational to abstract. I'm going to show you a few images from my classroom to just show what that might look like. So the standard for kindergarten is ways to make 5, addition and subtraction within 5. So we want to start as concrete as possible. Your hand is 5. So students got a popsicle stick. What are all the different ways? And then we drew it on a chart. We drew, oh, it could be over here. Oh, okay. Well, how many fingers over here? Oh, 2 are over here, 3 over here. Keeping it concrete. And then it's just barely starting to move to the representational. And I'm adding those numbers later. I added those numbers, but the focus is on that concrete here. Then students had Unifix cubes. With a partner, they broke off the Unifix cubes and looked at how many different ways could they make it so it's 2 towers. Oh, 0 and 5. And then we co-created anchor charts that were helping to build that structure so they could start to see the structure and serve as a public record so they could keep going back to it. And even the way that we store our tools, a small switch, like storing your Unifix cubes instead of just in tens, but in that 5 and 5, can be those little visual tweaks that may not seem to have a big impact, but really can. And then how we were exploring the unknown part through play. Students would hide some of the cubes. Okay, you have 5. How many are under the cup, or how many are behind my back? I know that there are 3 under the cup because I can see 2. So being as concrete as possible, using tools to see what are the different ways that we can make 5, representing that structure, solving a problem where we use 5 and we were looking at all the different ways the rabbits could be in and out of the hutch. Again, that example. And then again, moving to that more abstract where we are charting equations, we are looking at those numbers do matter, but students have that understanding of what 5 can be. So again, it's that concrete, that representational, and then the abstract. And that's the same for whichever grade you're in, right? How can we make an idea back in that very first classroom that I was talking about, pre-internet blip? How can those teachers were using those things, to those shape pieces, to be as concrete as possible to make rectangles. It wasn't some abstract drawing on the wall. They're physically manipulating shapes to create those rectangles. And I am not anti-curriculum. I believe curriculum is very powerful, but I also think that we are teaching mathematics, not the curriculum, right? That's our goal, is to teach mathematics. So how can you find moments in the curriculum where you can adapt it? So in this first example, it has images of dots or dice or fingers. Well, why not stand across from a partner and make five? If I'm holding up this, what is the other way? Like doing it so it's more concrete, so I'm face-to-face with a partner. Using Rec and Recs or other tools instead of just a worksheet on the paper, making it physical so students are physically moving the beads. And I list some resources here. I talked about FactsWise. Jennifer Big Williams and Gina Kling have a book, Math Fact Fluency, with some games and assessment tools. And Graham Fletcher and Tracy Johnson Zager have Building Fact Fluency, a toolkit that has some really great visual representations. So those are worth checking out. And season 6 talked all about Math Fact Fluency. And I felt like we barely scratched the surface, right? We could have talked about it. So before we close out, a couple next steps. So, okay, these are questions that aren't solved, but these are the things that I'm trying to keep in mind as I think about our students, think about where we want our students to be. How can our students be with us more during core instruction? If my students are pulled out and they're only with me for 2 days, what does that mean for when they come back in? Do they still feel like they're a part of the math classroom? And again, IEPs, we're bound to follow them. We want to follow them if it's going to make a difference for these students, right? We want goals that as a team, we've made these goals with the families to help this student be successful. So I'm not ever saying chuck the goals out the window. I'm saying, what can these goals look like? To how can we be mindful of what's going to help our students to have the most success possible? How can we assess and reflect regularly to be sure the interventions we're doing are working? Let's not keep doing the same thing all year. Let's have these checks scheduled in, reminders for yourself. Is this working? Are there tweaks that I need? Ask the student, is it helping? And how can we better use the resources we have available to us? In one of our curriculums, there was this amazing remediation and assessment guide. Each unit had like hundreds of pages of ideas, and most teachers weren't using it because you had to log on to the online portal. Now, I'm not saying every single teacher should have logged on and used it for every single unit, but when you saw an opportunity where you needed more help, instead of going to Pinterest or Teachers Pay Teachers or digging through Google looking for something, are there resources right at our fingertips? Could we as a grade level team sit down and look through a unit of it to see what are some tools that are available so I understand that resource and can access it when I need it? And are there ways that we can build and support the capacities of our support providers? And our teachers? Are there more peer support? Are there people outside of our grade level team or on X that we can reach out to? Or things like EdWeb, where you're learning with and from educators. And are intervention strategies on grade level and consistent with grade level standards? Again, can we change the numbers, the images, the context? Can we use concrete tools? Can we find ways to move our cycle of instruction, concrete, representational, abstract? And are there opportunities for students who need one-on-one support to have supplemental support? Could I make a short little Zoom video and send it to families and say, hey, this is a little extra support that might be helpful as we're diving into this unit? Are there ways that peers can support each other in small groups? What would that look like? So again, I want to close out with an invitation that you pair with somebody in your school or your environment, and you get curious about what math intervention looks like in your school environment. Agree on a lens and some specific look fors ahead of time. What's the story of that mathematics that your student is experiencing? And again, I remind myself before I go in there, I am not making it about this particular teacher. I am not walking in, this teacher's good, bad, this, that, what. No. I'm looking at it as a lens of I'm curious about what's happening and how can we all work together to help students succeed. So list of references, and I know we're out of time. I'm happy to stay on for a minute or two and answer a couple questions. And again, any questions I didn't get to, I will answer over on Twitter/X. I'm at LockhartEDU. And again, I apologize for that tech blip, but I kept breathing, Ryan, despite
you the handled it with grace, failure. Bethany.
Let me drink some water.
Okay, I just want to go ahead and share a couple of free resources from Amplify before Bethany answers a question or two. So I have a special invitation for all of you to join us at our free math symposium on March 12th. It will be 5 hours of free professional learning. If you cannot make it for the entire time, or you can't make it at all because it is during the school day, please still feel free to register at amplify.com/2024 math symposium, because all of the sessions will be recorded and you still have an opportunity to get a certificate of attendance. So I definitely recommend you register for that and join us over there on March 12th. If you want to be in the know of all things math for K-5 at Amplify, join our math interest list at amplify.com/getmoremath. And we'd love to have you over at our math Facebook community, where we are constantly sharing resources, professional learning opportunities, and great activities, just all you could ever imagine in there at facebook.com/groups/math teacher lounge. So again, please join us for our math symposium. We'd love to have you. It's going to be a great day on March 12th. But with that, I think we have time for like one or two questions for Bethany. So one of the questions that I really thought that we should go over, Bethany, is how can you convince other teachers that using tools is not indicative of lacking understanding of a concept?
Oh, that's a great question. I gotta say, it's pretty hard to convince others in any area of life of anything, is my opinion. So I wonder if you could share what's happening in your classroom. If during a staff meeting or during a grade level team, you could share and say, I want to share with you something that we did, and show images or show a quick 2-minute video clip of your students using tools and introduce them to what that could look like. Also, I think reminding people that mathematicians use tools, I think, is a really great reminder. When we think of tools as more broadly than just Unifix cubes or something that they may say like, well, I don't want you to be dependent on it. Mathematicians use tools all the time. We as teachers use tools all the time. So I think if we can remind folks of that, if that comes up or if they ask it, and I think also asking them, what are you worried about? And a lot of times it's worried about it getting out of control or getting messy. And how can you share what's working for you in your classroom? And what worked well for me was when I introduced a new tool, I started out with a tool talk. We sat around, I gave students some time to touch the tool, to feel the tool. And we also talked about, how do we use it appropriately? How do we use it safely? Well, you know what? It is something that we do need to respect, because I don't want these things broken. I want us to be able to use them all year. When can we use these? And then I gave them a problem where I invited them to use them if they wanted to. And I also, during my share outs, I took pictures of people using tools. So I really tried to norm it and said, wow, I love how you use these tools, and make it a part of, like, you know, where I would show a student using more than one type of tool. So students saw representations of that, or show an image of a student that you get from, you know, another classroom or Google or whatever, of a student using tools, and in your classroom, talk about how are they using these tools to solve the problems. So you make it really clear that it's something that you celebrate and that you think that you believe in. And then I wonder what could happen if you then say, hey, I want to share what I did in my class today. It was really exciting. And see if the teacher is receptive to that. I would hope that they could then respond, or like invite them, say, hey, could we all try this activity where we try this tool? And maybe it's something that is really readily available in your school. So the idea of having to buy something wouldn't be the thing that could block it or keep it from being tried out.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Bethany. Yes, Hunter, I see that you're asking if you could watch the symposium afterwards and still get your certificate of attendance. Yes, if you join us for our math symposium, if you're not able to join us for our math symposium on March 12th, the recordings will be available as soon as that webinar has ended. And so you will still be able to go back and watch those sessions and submit to get a certificate of attendance. I do want to be cognizant of people's time. So I think that if we would like to get other questions answered, we should join Bethany over on X. And what's your handle again, Bethany? I know it was on one of these slides.
It's at LockhartEDU. That's my maiden name. LockhartEDU. And over the next couple of days, I will... Ryan's going to send me those questions and I will answer those. And I'm happy to continue the conversation there. And, I hope that the time was well spent. I know we just scratched the surface and there's so much that we want to get a chance to share. Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.